Okay, this is going to be a part two of I'm not sure how many messages having to do with the gospel. And the last time I tried to demonstrate from a variety of different scriptures that the gospel is not words. The gospel can be described by words or by good news, but it cannot be experienced as words. Hearing the words, believing the words, singing the words, or even preaching the words isn't knowing the gospel. Because, like Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God. The words of the gospel describe the effectual working of the power of God in the hearts of those who believe. And this power is what all of us have to experience if we're ever going to really know the gospel. Imagine for a minute that a person came to visit a prisoner who was locked up in a nasty, horrible underground dungeon. And this person told the prisoner, "I have good news for you. The king has set you free. You no longer have to remain here. Now, follow me, and I'll show you the way out of this disgusting place." Well, that's good news. That's exciting news. Those are exciting words. And the prisoner begins to rejoice and to celebrate his freedom. However, if the prisoner did not actually follow the man out of the dungeon, I mean, if he stayed in the same place, proclaiming his freedom, talking about his freedom with the other prisoners, singing about the greatness and the kindness of the king, well, that wouldn't amount to any real change in his condition. He still wouldn't know freedom. And that's sadly more or less what a great number of Christians do. Let's change the analogy to something more familiar. A generation of Israelites was born in Egypt. They lived in a hopeless state of slavery and oppression. They were governed by a power, the power of Pharaoh, who had absolutely no intention of ever letting them go. And so the Lord visited them in that condition of slavery, Egypt. He manifested there his power, manifested his judgments against the cruel oppression of Egypt. He openly declared his intention many times to make a way for the people to leave that land and to follow him into a land that flows with milk and honey. And more than that, he gave them a Passover lamb, which was the price of their redemption. And by the death of that lamb opened up the Red Sea so that everyone that wanted to could follow him across the sea and across the wilderness into the promised land. Now, what if a large group of Israelites who had lived in Egypt their entire lives heard these words, heard the words of Moses, heard the words of God, experience something of the power of God shaking Egypt, bringing plagues upon Egypt, doing miracles. But then, instead of actually leaving Egypt, they all just began to form churches and small study groups that talked about and sang about God's power and about the beauties of the promised land. So they gathered together every week, they appointed leaders, they performed ceremonies and rituals celebrating what they had seen and experienced or what they thought that they were going to experience in the future. They talked about what they saw in the plagues of Egypt. They talked about what they felt when God visited Egypt. And then they also started to teach Moses' words and repeat what he had said to them and interpret his words according to their own understandings and experiences, and reciting often the stories of God's plagues and his judgment of Pharaoh. But they still never left Egypt. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but what I'm trying to suggest to you is that that's precisely what most of us do. And I'll confess to you, openly, honestly, that's exactly what I did. And the Lord has had to show me these things about my own heart. He's had to show me that I was reading, I was studying, I was singing and celebrating, and even seeing from a distance in His light some of the realities and truths of the promised land. But He's had to show me that I had barely taken any real steps out of Egypt. Now, you could most certainly and truly say that Moses came to Egypt and declared the good news of the gospel. He declared that God was going to defeat Pharaoh and that God was bringing judgment on the powers of darkness and that he was giving his Passover lamb as a price for their redemption and opening the Red Sea as a way for Israel to cross into the wilderness and towards the promised land. All of that was good news. All of those words were great and true words. But let me ask you, according to the story that you've certainly read in the Bible, how many of those people really experienced God's salvation? Really experienced true freedom from Egypt? What is Egypt? I mean, what does Egypt represent? Egypt doesn't represent a physical place. It doesn't represent a spiritual place. It doesn't represent bad habits or wrong doctrines or even a state of unbelief in God. It's not just a place that represents before I believed in God. No, Egypt is the condition of the natural man. It's the condition of the fallen fleshly man. It's the slug condition that I described last time. Egypt is what man has become. It's the first birth. It's his first fleshly birth that has lost the image and likeness of God, that has fallen into a slavery to self-love, to self-pleasure, that lives constantly in the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eye, the pride of life, under the dominion of a spiritual Pharaoh who has no intention of ever letting any of us go. Now, the good news of the gospel is that there's a way, a new and living way, as Hebrews says, provided for us to come out of that condition, to really experience a true liberty from that condition, to actually change our condition and become something different. The good news is that God has provided a power, the life and grace of Jesus Christ that comes into our Egypt, like Moses, to bring us out, that works in us according to his power, like a mustard seed that spreads and fills the wild garden of our hearts, or like leaven that fills and changes the whole measure of meal. The gospel is that power that has been given to us as our guide out of Egypt. It's a power that can change us entirely, change our condition, change us from a slug into a man, make a new creation in Christ Jesus. It's a power that can crucify us to sin, crucify us to flesh, to the world. But as I mentioned last time, to simply call us something different, just because we believe the words of the gospel, now that would be a huge mistake. And let me just make a parenthetical comment here so that we can avoid a common objection. Salvation is indeed by faith and not by works. But true faith is far more than just believing the words of the gospel. True faith is a living thing. It's a gift from above. It's a gift that Peter says in Acts 15 purifies the heart. Paul says in 1 Timothy 3:9, it's held in a pure conscience. Salvation is indeed by faith, but real faith, as Hebrews 11 says, sees him who is invisible. It follows the footsteps of Abraham, Romans 4. Those who know real faith don't just believe things by faith, they live by faith, they walk by faith, they grow strong in the faith, Romans 4 again. And 1 Peter 1, they receive the end of their faith, the salvation of their souls. I'm not going to be talking much about faith in these messages, but I just wanted to mention that because I just said that it would be a great mistake to simply call us something different because we believe the words of the gospel. Believing the words of the gospel and the living faith are not the same thing. Now, as I mentioned before, there's a great deception in the church today that the gospel is God's ability to call us something that we're not, rather than make us something entirely different than we are. We think about salvation as an instantaneous, automatic thing, like an external transaction, like a change in legal status, or some kind of new invisible position that we now have. 5 minutes ago, we say, I wasn't saved, but now that I said the sinner's prayer, now I'm saved. But let me just ask you to think about this with real humility before the Lord. Saved from what? Maybe you say, I'm saved from having to go to hell in the future. Okay, I'll leave that alone for now and just ask you this. Are you saved from your pride? Are you saved from your lusts? Are you saved from your old man, your bondage to sin, your love of the world, your overwhelming insecurities? Are you saved from your selfishness, from the total lack of real heavenly love in your heart? Are you saved from your carnal mind? What about your plaguing unbelief? Are you saved from your foolish jesting, from your manipulative words, from your spiritual blindness? Are you saved from the feelings of emptiness and discontent that you always feel in your soul? Are you saved from your anger, from your irritation, your bitterness? Are you saved from living in this world as a creature of this world? Are you saved from earthly passions, earthly desires, earthly treasures, earthly goals? In other words, have you been saved from being a slug? Now, I'm in no way questioning whether or not you've truly felt the love of God, the awakening power of God visiting you in Egypt. I have no desire to question that or doubt that at all. I believe you have. I believe we've all felt God's call out of Egypt's darkness in various ways. God certainly did visit Egypt. He appeared to them when they were in slavery. He appeared to them. He awakened them. He called to them. He set before them an open door. But he didn't appear in Egypt in order to remain there, nor to establish his church there. He appeared in Egypt to manifest his power, to manifest his judgments against that condition of death and darkness and slavery, and to call people out from it. In the same way, he appears to us in our fallen condition. He touches us. He calls us. He lets us feel something of his power, something of his mercy, something of his judgments. But all of it is with the purpose of calling us out of that condition and truly changing what we are, changing that condition, transforming us by the power of his Spirit into something entirely different. Not in an invisible, indiscernible way where we say we have a new position with God, but our hearts remain exactly the same as always. That's not what he's come to you for. The change of a slug to a man is as real of an experience as the change from a man was to a slug. And so I say again, the gospel isn't words. The gospel is power. And the power of the gospel isn't a power to call us something that we're not. These are great misunderstandings, and honestly, I think they're great deceptions in the church today. So many of us, and I have been one of them, have seen something and felt something of his appearing, we've heard his call, and yet have not experienced the power of God that creates all things new in Jesus Christ. So many talk and preach and sing about the blessings of a heavenly land, but we haven't even really begun to leave behind the land of Egypt, not in our hearts. I mean to leave behind that whole fleshly life, that whole first birth, the whole natural man, the old man. We've known nothing of the daily cross that really crucifies us to the world and crucifies the world to us. They haven't left behind that dark, dead, enslaved, and contrary nature. And yet, they consider themselves to be safe and secure just because they've believed the words or because they've felt the kindness of the Lord visiting them in Egypt and calling them out. Now, I have no doubt that the Lord has done this in some measure in the hearts of every one of you. He's appeared to you in one way or another. He's manifested himself to you. Sometimes that begins with a deep conviction for sin and evil that we've never felt before. Sometimes it's a sort of spiritual sight that suddenly gives us an ability to see or a certainty regarding the truth of spiritual things. Sometimes the Bible suddenly comes alive and the words jump off the page and pierce our hearts in a way that we've never felt. All of these things are real experiences, and they're good experiences, and they're necessary experiences. But they're often the manifestations of God to a people who are still living in Egypt. I mean, people who are still living in the flesh, living in the first birth, living in the fallen nature, the natural man, living in the vanity of their own thoughts, in their own will, in their own carnal mind that is enmity, Paul says, with God. They're the manifestations of God in mercy and in judgment to call us out from what we are and from where we are. But when we feel these things and don't actually follow him out, when we're visited and we're convinced, but we still remain in Egypt, this becomes an enormous problem. You could maybe say that this is the root of all problems that we have in the church today. And why is that? Because flesh, or again, the first birth, continues to occupy the throne. Even though our minds have been convinced, and maybe our bodies have been touched by the power of God, our beliefs have changed, but our nature hasn't. And so we say we've left Egypt, but Egypt still reigns in our hearts and in our thoughts. Egyptian appetites, the flesh pots that we long after, Egyptian desires, Egyptian perspectives, Egyptian treasures continue to govern our steps. And so we cling to our own fleshly ideas about God. We cling to our own thoughts about who he is and what he wants and what it means to follow him and to serve him. We've felt real convictions, we've experienced some real awakenings, some real callings out of Egypt, but so often we continue to meet together in the wrong life, in the wrong man, in the wrong land, talking and teaching and singing and arguing about a kingdom that we've not even really experienced. And so my question to you is not whether you've had some of those experiences, but whether you have left or are truly leaving behind that kingdom and that condition. Or as I stated it before, whether you know the effectual working of the power of the gospel to restore you to what man once was. Has the gospel changed your heart? Has the gospel cleansed your soul? Has the gospel given you a new spirit with new desires, with new understanding, with a new will, with heavenly love, heavenly goodness and wisdom? Has it restored God's image and likeness in you to what they were in the beginning? I have no idea and no desire to argue with anybody about whether or not they're going to be saved from hell when their body dies. But I will say this, that God is desiring to save you right now from everything in you and of you that is contrary to his nature and his purpose. In fact, I want to say very plainly that salvation should not be considered a future event, but rather a very present and active power. It's the power of the life of Jesus Christ that needs to work now in the heart of man to destroy the works of the devil, to perfect holiness in the fear of God, to sanctify you entirely in body, soul, and spirit, to conform you to the image of the Son of God, to transform you into the same image from glory to glory. You know that all these verses are declared in Scripture and that the apostles were not writing these things to people who were dead or who had already left this world, but rather to people who are still in the body. And let me just ask you this question. To those who think about salvation as a future thing, why are you so sure that God will save you in the future if you're refusing to let Him save you right now from your own sin and pride and lust? I mean, why should you expect God to save you in the next life if you're not letting Him save you in this one? And while I'm on this subject, I want to ask you to pause for a minute and just consider with me the fact that this one thing is the reason why you were created and why you were given an immortal soul. This is the only reason why you've been given time and place in a body of flesh. Of course, you know that you're not a body that has a soul. No, you're a soul, a spiritual being that for a very short time has an outward biological body of flesh and blood. As Paul tells us, this corruptible body of flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom of God. But your body does afford you time and place to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to will and to do for His good pleasure. Philippians 2:12. The greatest thing you can do with your time is, like Paul says in Galatians 5:16, redeem the time, because the days are evil. Time is not yours to do with it whatever you like. I mean, it was not given to you for you to waste it on the passing pleasures of the outward man. What a terrible waste of precious time. To spend our time in the body trying to just tickle the sinful pleasures of a fleshly tent that's soon going to be buried 6 feet under the ground. What a horrible tragedy to squander such a precious gift and to be left like the virgins who slept when they still didn't have any oil on their lamps. Or like the man that was given the talent who said, Lord, I went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, I'm giving back to you what's yours. And the Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have at least received back my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. Paul tells us really plainly why we've been given time and place. In Acts chapter 17, verse 26 and 27, he says, and he, God, has made from one blood every nation of men who dwell on all the face of the earth, and he's determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that, here's the purpose statement, so that they should seek the Lord and hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. We're given time and place to seek and to grope after and to find the Lord. This is what time is for. This is why you're here. And if you do this, if you sincerely and humbly do this, live like this, then you will begin to find not just true words, not a new position or a new legal status, not just a new set of doctrines and beliefs. No, you'll find a light that shows you what you are and where you are. And you'll find a power that seeks to save you from it.